are those of the speakers, and we're going to kick it off with Glenn Ford, like we often do. Got some Mumia Abu-Jamal, because he's got some really good stuff in light of the upcoming State of the Union address coming up, and at least I think of it in those terms. Maybe he is, too. Amy Goodman's got a piece about an international issue, the Kurd that Turkey wants to reclaim and torture some more. And then I've got some material from the, well, I may get to some little bit from Law and Disorder, but depending on how loquacious I am. There was an event sponsored by Carol Ammons this week at the IMC called Community Conversations About Prison Legal Reform. And I believe that's the title. You can find it on Facebook and maybe on her website as well. But, yeah, how much better is that? And I've got excerpts from the Q&A period. I still have to work on the introductory remarks. I did it for UPTV, so there should be a video version available forthwith if you do that kind of thing. So this is News from Neptune. I'm Paul Muth. This is the radio version, long-standing show here at the station, I guess, I might say. And like I say, I have these regular things that I do at the beginning. And, Sundiata is a guest for live in the studio with the Labor Hour, talking about a variety of issues, I'm sure. I sort of will be going out on his, the non-answer from the federal attorney that was in the forum. There was also a head of the Judiciary Committee in the State House was also involved. I'll have some further introductions at the bottom of the hour when we get to it. But let's kick it off with Glenn Ford. I actually haven't previewed this yet, but again, he provocative as usual.
The armed right-wing activists that seized control of a federal wildlife sanctuary compound in eastern Oregon have already committed and conspired to commit enough serious criminal violations of U.S. law to land each of them in federal prison for the rest of their lives. Of course, as Wajahat Ali points out in the Guardian newspaper, if the gunmen were Muslim or black, they'd already be dead. This is not a great revelation. Every black child knows that white lives carry a premium value in the United States, while black lives are casually killable. In a society where walking while black, driving while black, or simply breathing while black is so often treated as a capital crime, the racial double standard is the norm. That's why it's insane to think that this society can be made worthy of black habitation through tinkering with the system, piecemeal reforms, and appeals to the federal government for protection and relief. This is the same federal government that framed poor black men from Miami and Newburgh, New York on terrorist conspiracy charges, and that condones conspiracy indictments carrying life in prison for 100 black youngsters from New York City housing projects, based on their postings in Facebook. But the white, right-wing land-grabbers who are in armed occupation of federal property can't seem to buy a confrontation with President Obama's FBI or any other armed federal agency. How is it, the people of the world must be wondering, that a country that runs by far the world's biggest prison system, with the most heavily armed cops on the planet, equipped with the most advanced evidence-gathering equipment known to man, how is it that the superpower of policing and prosecution seems to fear a confrontation with groups with names like the Oregon Bearded Bastards? The reason is really quite simple. The U.S. criminal justice system was not created to control white militias or greedy ranchers or gun-toting racists and Bible thumpers. For most of U.S. history, these were prime stakeholders in the American project to build a white man's nation. The gunmen in Oregon have plenty of historical reasons to believe that land grabbing is their birthright and that a significant segment of white America empathizes with them. The federal government treads lightly. For almost 50 years, the primary mission of the U.S. criminal justice system has been to control, contain, and incarcerate black Americans. It has spent half a century refining the tools to terrorize black people on the streets, in their homes, and in their schools. It is so efficient at what it does that one out of every 8 prison inmates on the planet is an African American. The mass black incarceration state was designed to preempt any insurgency by black people, not to deal with the Bundy family and the bearded bastards of Oregon. That's why I think the lords of capital are much more afraid of Donald Trump than they are of Bernie Sanders. They think Trump might stir up more of those white bearded bastards, many of whom hate Wall Street almost as much as they do the federal government, which is a real problem for U.S. law enforcement. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Yep, he laid it out. Regular feature, Bruce Dixon's got the week off, apparently. Always like his commentaries, too. They're no less provocative, but he's so mild-mannered. All right, enough about those guys. We'll be getting to Amy Goodman shortly, but there's a short, potent essay from Mumia Abu-Jamal that I just realized now is an incredible counterpoint, because he's talking about the war against white men. Not the one that's not happening against the militia, but he's going back to this study that showed that mortality rates in white men of a certain strata or class, basically, are actually overshot that of black males and everyone else. And he ties it to NAFTA, which I think is a great idea, since we're going to be fed a bill of goods about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, apparently. Obama's a great speaker, but as far as doing real action and defending TPP will be a big one, a big stretch. So hopefully his advocacy of it will torpedo it in the irredentist House. I don't care how it's not passed, but it's an awful thing. It's more corporate power, and it undercuts any kind of agreements about climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And it was highlighted this week, too. It's notable. People are hailing it as a boon for the environmental movement. The Keystone XL people, TransCanada, are going to sue for the lack of money they made, or the money they didn't make, using provisions of a trade agreement, their opportunity costs, for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not just to pay them back for what they put into it, but to all the money they anticipated making while despoiling the planet. So, he ties it in pretty nicely, I think, Mumia Abu-Jamal, from his prison cell, where I contend he was framed, and the bad cops in Philly, who were eventually caught, corrupt cop system there, got rid of Dan Faulkner, who was apparently going to go evidence against the, this is what I understand, they was going to testify against his brethren and cross the thin blue line. And they got rid of a critic of who was a journalist for an NPR station, WHYY, wasn't it? Maybe another one in Philly. And it was a critic of the police. And they got rid of two at the same time, apparently. At least that's a contention, and it ought to be adjudicated in some way, it seems to me.
The war against white men. Several days ago, while viewing the weekly Sunday CNN show hosted by Fareed Zakaria, I saw a segment documenting the rising death tolls of white men, especially between the ages of 45 and 54 years. The causes were various: drug overdoses, car accidents, alcoholism, and suicides. Of course, some of the other causes, such as drugs or even car accidents, are actually hidden suicides sometimes. All other groups showed declines. I found it intriguing, especially when class and education were factored in, working class and high school diplomas or less. I've since read half a dozen articles, some scientific, others journalistic, from a variety of publications, many speculating as big a variety of speculations on causes. Failing health, low wages, fear of a changing, browning America, etc. Yet none of these articles touched on what initially came to mind. I'll call it the NAFTA effect for the North American Free Trade Agreement, which sent millions of manufacturing jobs across the border and U.S. businesses in search of cheaper labor. For me, this reason seemed obvious, especially since NAFTA was so widely known, for it affected jobs on both sides of the border, forcing wages lower and lower. An owner, for example, faced with union demands for higher wages, might easily threaten to go overseas to frighten labor leaders into concessions, even givebacks. NAFTA, the gift of Clinton I, was an executive betrayal of labor who fought for and funded the presidential campaign of William Jefferson Clinton. He betrayed them by making a sweet deal with the business class. It ain't the only factor, but I'm convinced it is a factor. Americans, once again, voting for their own betrayers. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, might have been in the can for a little while. Health problems affecting him, but I thought it was pertinent in that we're going to hear some rubbish about the TPP this week at the State of the Union. It'll be sort of the state of the world, I guess, right? We're going to just do a few chords here, a little bit of shake, rattle, and roll from the Painkillers who are holding forth. We've got two other things, musical interludes queued up. Todd Rentz playing the same place, the Iron Post, and Lamont Parsons got his buddy Joe Boyce in with vibraphone this coming Sunday. So hopefully get a sample of all of that. This is the more raucous one, so I'll start with this. It's also the one that's happening at 6 this evening, too, so... So the real way to hear that is live, obviously. So, happening tonight. Okay, Amy Goodman's up next. I almost forgot her. And she's got this more international issue that's worthy of your attention. State of the world. I doubt whether Turkey will come up too much. It ought to, as well as our friends in Saudi Arabia. How's it being put lately? The real Islamic State. The one that has kings and everything. All right, here's Amy Goodman talking about this plaintiff case. Being adjudicated in Chicago, I guess that's the federal seat for the... But the Kurdish guy that's lived in Detroit for many, many years. It's quite moving, and she capsulizes it here in this Breaking the Sound Barrier essay.
An act of terror deporting a Kurdish activist back to Turkey. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In the quaint tourist town of Harbert, Michigan, sits an unassuming restaurant that's been owned and operated by a man who's considered a pillar of his community. Cafe Gulistan is owned by Ibrahim Parlak. He is, by almost all appearances, a classic example of the immigrant success story. There's just one problem. The U.S. government is trying to deport him to Turkey, where he has a well-founded fear of imprisonment, torture, and possibly death. After a quarter of a century here in the United States, he now has about 75 days left to fight deportation. Ibrahim Parlak is Kurdish, born in the region of Turkey called Anatolia in 1962. His childhood was marred by increasing government repression of Turkey's Kurdish ethnic minority. Turkey banned the Kurdish language, Kurdish cultural expression, and attempted to forcibly assimilate the Kurdish people to destroy their heritage. Resistance to that assimilation included protests and grassroots organizing, but also, by the 1980s, armed resistance from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. In the late 1970s, Ibrahim Parlak, a teenager, was jailed for 3 months for engaging in peaceful protests. He then moved to Germany to avoid further repression from the Turkish government. He remained active in the movement for Kurdish autonomy, hosting cultural events and raising funds for the political, non-military wing of the PKK, known as the National Front for the Liberation of Kurdistan. After 7 years in Germany, Parlak decided he could better support the Kurdish cause back home. Turkey had revoked his passport, so he decided to sneak into the Kurdish region of Turkey directly from Syria. As a group he was with was crossing the border, they were fired on. In the ensuing firefight, two Turkish soldiers were killed. Months later, he was arrested by Turkish authorities and charged with separatism. Although he was never charged with killing the two soldiers, Turkish authorities confirm he did not shoot that night.
I was captured and put in jail. And it took almost a month for a month, mistreated. Tortured, and he it's not the memory you want to revisit.
That's Ibrahim Parlak on Democracy Now! It visibly pains him to recall the experience. A description that appears in a federal appeals court filing here in the U.S. from 2007 is chilling. It says, quote, "The Turkish gendarmes shocked him with electrodes, beat his genitalia, hung him by the arms, blindfolded him, and deprived him of sleep, food, water, and clothing, and anally raped him with a truncheon over the course of almost a month," unquote. Ultimately, Parlak was imprisoned for close to a year and a half. Ibrahim Parlak eventually fled to the United States, where he received asylum and began the long process of building a life. He received his green card and in 1999 applied for citizenship. By this time, the PKK had been designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department, so the mention of the group in his file delayed his application. After September 11, 2001, the process for gaining citizenship transformed. Eager bureaucrats from the newly minted Department of Homeland Security were looking for terrorists in the mosques, parks, schools, you name it. Ibrahim Parlak fit their bill just fine, and the American dream he built came crashing down. Parlak was arrested and jailed while awaiting deportation, but community support for him was incredible. A former FBI counterterrorism lawyer volunteered to represent him. People he'd worked with for years and even local police testified to his character. After 10 months in a county jail, a federal judge ordered his release, stating, "He's been a model immigrant. He's not a threat to anyone nor a risk of flight. He has strong ties to the community," unquote. Since then, Parlak has been on deferred action for deportation, meaning he can be grabbed at any time and deported to Turkey. He has support from Republican Congressman Fred Upton, had the support of Senator Carl Levin, the Democrat of Michigan, until Levin retired last year. His supporters are asking Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters, both Democrats, to file a bill protecting Parlak, but to date, neither has. The dean of the University of Chicago Law School has asked for President Barack Obama to pardon Parlak. Turkey, meanwhile, has escalated its military assault on the Kurds and has imposed harsh curfews and intense censorship of any dissent. Many are concerned about the grave danger Parlak faces if he's deported to Turkey. His lawyer, Rob Carpenter, told us that Parlak has received, quote, "private Facebook threats of modes of torture that were never made public before, indicating it must be one of several guards who tortured him during those 17 months before he fled to the United States," unquote. Ibrahim Parlak is back at his Cafe Gulistan, his future uncertain. The U.S. government contends he's a terrorist, although he's never been found guilty of committing a violent act. Deporting him, however, would be an act of terror in itself. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, I guess I have a little time for some music. I think I will play this excerpt from Law Disorder, Law and Disorder. Law is some of the issue with a community. Conversations about justice reform be coming up in the second half hour. And it'll feature some questions. I think the questions maybe are more interesting than the answers generally. James Kilgore, Belden Fields, and Sunday Adichajua, who will be on live in the studio with the Labor Hour in the next hour. So I feel like I'm teeing up. I have hopefully a little more information on that as it comes closer, but this is coming up Sunday at the Iron Post, and I should hear a little bit of the vibes here of Joe Boyce, who's in from Atlanta, Georgia. Former resident, I guess, in Danville. But just relax after that a little bit. Bringing it all the way up from Georgia, the vibraphone there. I not often hear him deployed, so when I hear that live in full glory, that's at the Iron Post. Blurbed in Downbeat as a jazz venue. How about that? Living up to it this week, it seems. Okay, I've got a little excerpt. It's a quick edit. Realized I'd have a little more time. I might play all of this tomorrow. This is from Law and Disorder for January 4th. And it's about a lawsuit, actually, against the Department of Revenue at the federal level for allowing tax-deductible charities to invest in and donate money to occupied territories. I think it's a narrowly defined issue, and it's more of an international issue, but heck, it doesn't get any discussion and probably won't be mentioned. But, okay, we'll have time to hear most of the response by Jim Lewis, U.S. Attorney, that's federal level for the Central District of Illinois, who joins L.G. Simmons, who's chair of the Judiciary Criminal Committee, so it's the subcommittee called the Criminal. I guess that's right. It's up on the Facebook account. And obviously convened by Carol Ammons. She's got another community conversation on the Robin Hood tax, the Tobin tax, also called the LaSalle Street tax, coming up. That's a few weeks away still, so we'll get the specifics on another time. But here's a little excerpt with the interview with attorney Martin McMahon.
People are encouraged by then Housing Minister Sharon to grab hilltops owned by Palestinians, because in the final analysis, when the final borders are set, if we don't grab that stuff, you know, then we can't keep it. So basically, the settler movement was borne out by Sharon's, who's the father of settlements, by the way, his desire to sprinkle Jewish settlers all over the OPT, because he knew the day of reckoning would come, final borders are set, and if you have something built up. And that was basically 40 years ago, I guess. So they were looking for cheap real estate, and they received economic incentives from the Israeli government and decided, you know, it's too expensive to live in Haifa, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem. Let's live out here in the boondocks. And the problem was that when they first set up, they lived in tents, had no electricity, had no water, sewer. I mean, they were really pioneers. So their Jewish brethren in basically, America decided, you know, we should help our folks. And the way we help them is financial assistance so they can have a permanent living structure, hospitals, universities. And 40 years later, Ariel has 25,000 people. It started with six tents and two outhouses. Now it has 25,000 people. They have a fantastic university, a fantastic medical center, hospitals all over the place, movie theaters, drama, you know, everything under the sun, and vast infrastructure improvements. And they even have an aerial university, which is basically illegal because it was built on private land, as conceded by a number of Israeli officials and, you know, distinguished authors.
Martin, why do you say that the U.S. Treasury Department has a double standard?
Well, it's kind of obvious. Sometimes folks make too much of the Israeli lobby, but I think it's fair to say that Treasury, for a lot of reasons, has looked the other way when it comes to pro-Israel or pro-settlement 501c3s. Because, you see, and this stuff is nothing new. People have been writing about it for years. I don't know, you know, if you guys were involved. But you start reading about it and you say, wow, why don't we do something about this? Isn't this an effective way to stop settlement funding? My past litigation experience, by the way, I was a I clerked at Gravatt, Swain & Moore, and I was a litigation associate at Proskauer Rose. I learned there that you must have a focus on your litigation. So this is one step, I hope, a positive step, to stop the funding of settlement expansion. Because you can talk all you want, but Netanyahu and his crew are just building settlements up the wazoo. In fact, just a week ago, a guy near Ariel said, you know, I saw the bulldozers come. I know they're going to evict me. I have no money. I have no weapons. I can't defend myself. I'm going to lose all my property. And he lives right near Ariel. So my point is settlement expansion is still going on, and Israeli government officials have been lying to Congress for probably 30 years. And through devious means, confiscation of state property, confiscation of property for bogus security reasons, they basically have demolished, I think, 49,000 Palestinian homes, and they've built 56,000 new apartment buildings and homes in the OPT, clear evidence of ethnic cleansing. And then Seamus and I started to realize, wow, settlement expansion is a very profitable game. No wonder they're not going to stop. In fact, if you just take the 26,000 homes that were sold and you use REMAX property values, REMAX, Bank Leumi, and, well, I guess who else, Seamus? The housing developers. You know what they grossed? $9.5 billion.
Wow.
Holy moly.
And
then
if you consider the infrastructure improvements and apartment buildings and shopping malls and everything under the sun, it's about $30 billion. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is, you know, follow the money, folks, the KISS theory. This is a very attractive investment for all concerned, and we're not going to stop even if we're violating Israeli criminal law and we're promoting ethnic cleansing.
How come you sued the Department of Treasury? Why didn't you sue the donors or the not-for-profits that funneled this money over there? How come you went after the Department of Treasury?
Well, I think this is a two-step dance for us. The first step is to sue the administrative agency that has the authority and the staff to investigate money laundering, to investigate tax-exempt entities, and to revoke their status. So this is the first step, I think, in our campaign to help the Palestinian people. And unless you start with the administrative agency who is in charge, you're not going to go anywhere. And plus, a litigator's dream is to have other people do the hard, heavy lifting. So I hope Treasury does a lot of hard work and gives us evidence of what we think is really, you know, a pattern of criminal activity on the part of these 501c3s and the donors themselves. And that can provide us with an opportunity to address your issues, sir, about going after the donors.
Which include Sheldon Adelson. A lot of people could get behind that. This is from Law and Disorder Radio in the... Martin McMahon was the litigator. And the interviewers were Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Right. He's emeritus founder or something. And Heidi Boghossian with the A.J. Musty Foundation now, formerly with the National Lawyers Guild. You can find that at lawanddisorder.org. I love that. There's a, in the text here on the splash page, this is the current episode, there's an estimate of a resulting loss in U.S. tax revenue of $1 trillion. So we heard $1 billion thrown around quite liberally there in that section. But that's $1 trillion lost tax revenue. I don't know what that represents and how much largesse was sent that way without paying any taxes. So I know it's provocative. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And it's about half past. We might have time for one more musical outro. Labor Hour is coming up. Maybe I'll put it in between. I attended the community conversation about criminal justice reform. There were a lot of local officials. Both police chiefs were there, though. They did bow out a little bit early. They made their representation. The News Gazette had no coverage that I could find yesterday or today. Maybe they're holding it off till Sunday. I don't know. It wasn't covered as a news item. Maybe they'll cover it with a Jim Day column or something, or Die. I guess it is Die. Anyway, we're going to get to this straight away. I copped the audio off of the UPTV recording that I did, so it should be available at UPTV for your perusal on video. I will make the audio available through Citizens for Peace and Justice Facebook page, and maybe the new IMC page, too. It was recorded over there. We tried to get it on the air, but we had a technical difficulty that called us away, so we figured we should just get good sound to the people in the crowd there. It's, like I say, pretty well attended. Carol Ammons convening, State Representative L.G. Sims, again, chairperson of the Judiciary Committee, focusing on criminal activities. That's loosely how it looks. Jim Lewis, touting his I went to jail for justice thing. He was involved in the civil rights movement and was arrested multiple times in the 60s. And he, a logical question to ask him would be if he thought it was reasonable to have civil disobedience against the current inequities in the criminal justice system, which a lot of people think is the case that should be done and is done widely in Chicago lately. And I think it's a great thing personally, though. I'm not encouraging you to break any laws. So, all right. Again, the entirety of it should be available pretty soon. But I clipped out the salient question answer. All guys. There was a good question by a woman, but there were some audio problems with it. So maybe you can get that on at a later date or make it available at the places I indicated and try to make it available. So James Kilgore, I'm queued up first. Belden Fields has the question just following, and then Sundiata Chajua, who again will be on the Labor Hour straight away. And I guess I just have enough time to get this all on. So see, Gus Woods is in the house, so he'll be around. I think he's a student of Sundiata's, so as well. Okay, hopefully this... This may be on one channel or the other, so bear with me. I didn't have time to condense it to mono, which I should have, but there was a hang-up in that, too, in the processing.
Yes, sir. James Kilgore, I'm a local activist, and I'd like to thank you for your presentation and also for your efforts on the reform bill and combating the budgetary madness that confronts us. At the same time, I'd like to maybe shift a little bit. I know it's difficult when you're in the day-to-day struggle to focus on big picture, but I'd like to focus a little bit on the corrections, the prison system in Illinois, and the fact that our prison system hasn't reduced its population since 2006. And from my study of this, I think Illinois has the worst racial disparity of any state in the union, 13% black population, 58% black population in the prisons. So I'd really like to hear a little bit of a big picture vision, 5 years, 10 years. How do you envision really dealing with this incredible situation that we have of mass incarceration? Some of the issues that were raised earlier by the brother from Chicago, to what are the measures, what are the issues, what are the steps, what's the process to decarcerate and also to get some of the resources that have been poured into corrections, into prison building, what's the process to get some of those into the communities that have been so decimated by mass incarceration? So just to share with us some of the ideas that you have about how to deal with these problems.
I think first and foremost, looking at it as an opportunity. Right now, this is an opportunity. You're seeing how the correction, our focus on the correctional system, is impacting our budget as a whole. And that is why you're seeing so many folks who would not traditionally and typically be proponents of criminal justice reform. They are now proponents because it's fiscally impacting our state. Our correctional system is starting to crowd out other areas. If you are not able to effectively put money into education, you're not able to effectively invest in our mental health facilities and mental health system or healthcare systems. Now it's starting to crowd out the ability for government to do what it's fundamentally charged with doing, which is take care of people. And now we are seeing an opportunity, and we have to seize the opportunity. And part of what we have been doing, and we have been arguing about and fighting about in the Criminal Justice Reform Commission and debating and discussing, what is the criminal justice system really supposed to be about? And the criminal justice system is there. The criminal justice system is there to remove dangers from the community. It's not that we shouldn't be locking up nonviolent offenders. We shouldn't be locking up individuals who are not a threat to communities. We should not be locking away and locking up individuals who are mentally ill. You have not just in the state, but in Cook County and Champaign County and Sangamon County and counties all around the state, you're finding a large percentage of individuals who are mentally ill, but they are being locked away because there's no place else for them to go. One of the bills we passed this last session of the General Assembly is the mandatory establishment of curriculum for crisis intervention teams. Individuals who can identify folks who are suffering from mental illness, folks who are suffering from substance abuse problems, and then being able to deal with those individuals as opposed to engaging them in a situation that may often turn negative. So, well, we get there, and that's part of what we have to do. You've got to make sure that we are investing in these systems, and it takes time. But now that we are seeing this sea change, it's time to seize this opportunity. And if part of why discussions like this are so important, it's good that you're here, and I say, I want you to be here, but take away and come back and help Representative Ammons to establish an agenda that she brings back to the Illinois House. That's why these discussions are here. These discussions are not here just for everybody to feel good. Representative Ammons wants tangible takeaways that she can come back and advocate for. This is an opportunity, and if we miss it, shame on us. Period.
I just want to say, in relationship to my vision, certainly I'm one of the, I need 59 more votes, maybe 58 more votes on some of the rollback initiatives. I think I play two roles around mass incarceration issues for our community, but for the state. One of them is that, yes, we are actively working. So I'm blessed because most of these people in here are actually working with us to write legislation to bring to the House that's important to where we want to go on the vision. But the second thing is Representative Sims and the chair of this particular committee is really important, of judiciary. Because out of judiciary, and he will tell you the amount, I know Naomi can tell you the amount of just more punishment, longer sentences, those kind of bills that come through that clog the system up and give judges less room to make discretionary decisions, they come to that committee. And if we don't have people in those positions that can put a halt on so many of those things, we are just always playing catch up or on the back end. So we stopped several things in the last session that I'm sure will be reintroduced in this session that will increase incarceration as opposed to decrease it. So we have to play that role of defense, but we also have to be offensive. And what we talked about earlier at our office is rolling back some of this overreach, as Attorney Lewis described it, as the overreach in the criminal justice area, that we got all of this now punishment on top of punishment, on forever punishment for people even once they've served their time. So we got to get rid of all of those things. And as a new member, I always feel like we're playing catch up, so to speak. Right,
Carol, to that point, during the last session of the General Assembly, as we for the bills that would enhance penalties and things like that, and increase the correctional population, several billion dollars worth of bills were introduced. For the fiscal impact of bills that were introduced during the last General Assembly alone, several billion dollars that would have increased our prison population, would have increased all of the commitment for resources that we have to pay. Where is that money coming from?
The message that's in your question and the message in the answers you're getting is also the message that you get on the federal side. Attorney General Holder used to say to us, do you realize that 32% of the Justice Department budget goes to the Bureau of Prisons? And he made an effort, and he's had some degree of success, actually, for about the last 2 years, the federal prison population has decreased. So some of that is working. The other thing you need to understand about this country is that up until 1980, we had a relatively steady percentage of our people in prison, and it was consistent with the percentage in the rest of the world. And that went on for years and years and years. Our country was steady, and a decision was made in the 1980s to switch to mass incarceration. And now we are busy trying to unravel it, and it's hard to unravel, but we have an absolute obligation to unravel it and put the people in prison who truly need to be there. The other thing, and people have heard this too, the mantra used to be punishment should be swift, certain, severe. It isn't that anymore. The new message is swift and certain, but appropriate. And we have to relearn and really reexamine what is actually appropriate. We have to learn our way out of the hole that we as a society dug starting in 1980. And I don't want to defend why we did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to get back to standards. And I think that there are certain implicit standards that plague policing, not only in this community, but nationally. One of them is the standard that no other country that I know of, and I've traveled very widely, has, at least in Europe, adopts the shoot-to-kill policy. That is horrendous in the eyes of most European countries. A second standard that I think is very important has to do with what is regarded as, and I want to preface this by saying that I'm a union man. I've belonged to a union all of my working life. I've been an officer of the AFL-CIO locally. But I'm very disturbed by the way in which arbitration has prevented police officers who have committed what would be regarded as criminal acts by a private citizen is given very light punishment for what they have done. And in our case recently with the Champaign police officer, a dismissal by the chief was reversed, and it was 30 days. Suspension was sufficient for this person. Now, I want to say I think we need to distinguish between civilian public employees, where arbitration cannot harm the community as much, and police officers who have the unique right to use violence properly, hopefully, most of the time against the citizenry. And where it is so difficult to dismiss a police officer, even if the chief wants the officer out, I think we have to rethink this. And that gets back to the standards. I'm sure what the arbitrator does is look at past cases and how they've been resolved and say these are the standards. So you're always stuck. You're always stuck with the minimal here rather than be able to say, okay, there's certain people that ought not to be officers based on their behavior. They need to be out because the community suffers. It suffers financially because of all the civil suits that are millions of dollars being paid out by these cities in civil damages, and the officer stays on the force and continues to do the right thing. So I really do believe there has to be some rethinking, fundamental rethinking here. I want to get back to what Cindiata also said. I'll be very brief. I agree, Mr. Attorney, that most police officers are dedicated to their job and behave well. But the other thing, a standard in policing, is the wall of silence or the defense against a comrade who has acted badly. I think that's very problematic. I'd rather see a standard like in the military academies. When you see somebody doing something wrong, you call it to the attention of the superior. You don't just say, okay, we're comrades, we're going to defend this kind of behavior. Lots of stuff needs to be, fundamental stuff needs to be rethought, I think.
No, I agree with you on that. I think that, if I remember correctly, the Lachlan McDonald shooting in Chicago, there were six police reports, and they all said it was a justified shooting, and the video showed that it was not. So there is a problem, and everybody has to realize that's not in anybody's interest.
Yes.
That is not in anybody's interest to not tell the truth about something that happened. And by the way, it isn't in anybody's interest to hold on to a video. That's not in anybody's interest either. Now, having said that, your first point is the standard for use of force. I cannot quote it to you. But if you go on the internet, look at FBI standard for use of force, it's there. It's about one or two sentences long. It is consistent with court decisions. And right after Ferguson, I wanted to understand what that actually meant. And as you could figure out, my history is nonviolence. I don't have a gun in my house, and my wife would not permit it. And I wouldn't either, so that's where we are. But I went to the FBI, and I went to their training, and it is available to citizens. And you will find how quick and difficult it is to figure out justified and not justified. It is horribly, horribly difficult, and we need to have a little bit of empathy for that fact. And I went so that I could be educated for all of the discussions. My friends were on me. Everybody was on me. So I went and learned what is the standard for use of force and how difficult is it to actually follow that standard. It's tough. I don't know if there's a source around here, but in Springfield, they will put you through that if you ask the FBI. They'll put you through that training, and you'll come out of it with a bit more empathy for the difficulty.
Well, that was the view of Jim Lewis, federal attorney for the Central District of Illinois, and he also mentioned something similar to Cindiata in his question and answer. Seems to me that he has to realize that he's the judge, he's the attorney. He's going to get the deluxe version of the training, et cetera, and his experiences with ride-alongs, et cetera, are quite a bit different than other folks and the people that actually see what happens when there's not an outside observer around. Disclaiming the opinions there, I guess, is what I'm doing. We're going to get to Sundiata's question right now, and he'll be in live in the studio with his colleagues Gus Wood, etc. And again, this is all from community conversations on justice reform. And was at the IMC this week Thursday, and I'm still not getting that title exactly right, am I? That's the vagaries of using Facebook as a community conversation about criminal justice reform. Not that you needed to know, but it should be up on UPTV fairly. They do a good quick turnaround. This was sponsored by Carol Ammons, U.S. representative. And as I commented earlier, nothing in the Gazette yesterday or today, as far as I could tell. Maybe I missed a little squib, but there was no article to speak of in the local section or anything. So Channel 3 actually had a sit-down interview with Carol Ammons about the event. And okay. Here's another excerpt from the conversation.
Go ahead. Okay. First, I want to thank Representative Ammons for her leadership in this community, and I of course want to thank the representative for the law SB 1304. I think that it's a good reform, but it does not get us in a position to address some of the more concrete issues in policing. I've done some work as a trainer in terms of diversity with the Police Training Institute here, and to be quite frank,
it's 10 o'clock.
A large percentage, more than half, a lot more than half, of the police officers come with the type of racial bias that procedures will only have a middling impact upon. And we have to think about ways in which we begin to empower citizens and pull back some of the power of the police. So one of the things I'm interested in, is there a sense of people in the legislature on elements of the police, the Uniform Peace Officers Act, sometimes referred to as the Police Bill of Rights, that give police officers rights well above that of a citizen. Now, I fully understand that police officers are empowered to use force in ways that private citizens aren't. But when it comes to things like if I'm stopped for a crime and taken in to be investigated, they can start interrogating me immediately, right? I have to call for my lawyer. A police officer in all just no understanding of memory, right? What people who study memory tell us, they argue that their memory is better 24 hours to 48 hours after the incident, so they can't be interviewed for such a long time after an incident. Is there a move to begin to cut back on these special privileges that elevate police officers well beyond the citizenry? Because it seems to me that that's got to be part of any quote-unquote reform. The other piece, it seems to me that we have to deal with is that there has to be serious consequences for behaviors. And to what extent is there a push to get us out of some of these cul-de-sacs we're in? Police officer like Matt Rush here just brutalizes people. He's fired because of a mandated arbitration. He's back. There's got to be some path that intervenes in the contract where police officers, no, you must live in the community where you police. You know, we got to have some other kinds of things, and we can't ignore to talk about community. There's not one community, right? Community is always made up of various fragments and sectors, and so we got to speak very candidly about the relationship between the African-American community and policing. And I do understand that other communities now are beginning to see that policing has gotten out of control. But it does come fundamentally back to the African-American community, and we need to find ways to have consequences for bad behavior for police officers.
Professor, you had a lot of things in there. Okay. I'm glad Representative Ammons wrote them down. Let me start here. When I talked about Senate Bill 1304, I said it's not a perfect piece of legislation. No piece of legislation is. It is the result of negotiation. It is the result of individuals working to come to a common goal. And I think what you have before you in 1304 is a great step forward. Is it the last step? Absolutely not. Secondly, I talked about, that's why I always focus on not just the body cameras, because the body cameras are a tool. They're a tool, they're an objective tool when used appropriately that will give us a view of what happened in an interaction between the public and law enforcement. That's why I always talk about the training portion, because I think the training portion provides us with the greatest opportunity to change the quality of policing services that we receive. When officers go through the training and they have to confront their implicit biases that they may not understand that they have, but when they have to confront them, they are able to deal with them, and it's they're able to work through them and to improve the quality of the services that they provide. Finally, another portion that I didn't talk about came from Senate Bill 1304 is the Commission on Police Professionalism. Myself, Jim, as attorneys, we have to be licensed. Every year, the Attorney Registration Disciplinary Commission licenses me. So we are having a process now where this commission will discuss issues related to police licensing, issues related to police professionalism, to see if licensing is the right way to go. It's ultimately what we are trying to get to is a level of professionalism. And listen, law enforcement, we have some wonderful law enforcement officers out there. You know, they do an incredibly difficult job. They are running towards danger when most folks are running away from it. And I understand that. And you have to acknowledge that. But you have some bad actors, just like you have bad actors in everything. So this commission, it's going to talk about those issues. It's going to talk about issues of professionalism. It's going to talk about, you know, forum shopping or department shopping. We talked during the negotiations for this bill. We talked about several officer incidents, specific officer incidents, where you would have an officer who was a member of a small police department. Before he got disciplined, he resigned and went to another office or another department. And because of his rights, as an employee, as collective bargaining rights, the next department was not able to have the details about what caused him to resign in the previous employment. So now what we have as part of this new law is a database. If you are under investigation and you resign during dependency of that investigation, that goes into a database that law enforcement is in one department. So Urbana's department the chief of Urbana's department could then go into this database and see Officer X. Officer X resigned from Southern View, Illinois. And he resigned because he was under investigation for whatever the crime might be, official misconduct. Let's use that as an example. That information is then available to the chief of police to make an employment decision. Again, I think folks focus on the body cameras and some of the more sexy parts of this bill, but this is really a comprehensive new law that gives us some tools that will improve the quality of policing services around this state.
Let me try two things. One is to somewhat challenge your premise. I do an awful lot of work with law enforcement officers. I go talk to the sheriffs as a group several times a year with whatever seems to be going on. I address it. And I go talk to all the new chiefs of police, and I talk to chiefs of police, and I come to community meetings. You are underestimating the depth of good leadership and the depth of good officers, and the fact that officers go into that work for good reasons. I don't want to say there are just a few bad apples, because there are two problems. One, there are officers who do use bad judgment, and a bad judgment in Chicago reflects on every officer around the country, unfortunately, even though they had nothing to do with it. And secondly, there is a constant need for training and retraining. And that is true, and we talk about that. And that's how a force will be brought into being a better force. But I think you're underestimating the good in what you say, and I'm as horrified as you are when there are those examples of bad. And remember, I started my life with skepticism about law enforcement. It wasn't law enforcement, it was enforcement of a segregated system. That was their job. It really was not law enforcement. So I am a skeptical person, so I'm not a automatic, oh, you're an officer, you're right. But I have found a lot more good, and I'm sorry that you're not going around with me and finding the same thing.
Jim Lewis, again on his cred from his civil rights, civil disobedience days, and I repeat what I said earlier, is his ride-alongs aren't like other ride-alongs, and they certainly don't look like what when there's nobody riding along. That was Jim Lewis again, U.S. Attorney for the Central District of Illinois at the federal level. The other voice you heard there was L.G. Sims, S-I-M-M-S. He's chairperson of a Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Justice, I guess. And that was convened by State Representative Carol Ammons. It was this past Thursday. That was sort of the rough cut edit at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. And I've got a UPTV video. I've already turned in their copy, and I've got my copy. And it should be available for viewing in its entirety.